front of the car.
Guest. This is my friend from Florida. Just to show you guys that Florida really has some amazing people. Don't feel that way about Florida all the time. There's some wonderful people. I met this young man through Equality Florida, but since which is an incredible organization. Big ups to Nadine and all the folks there at Equality Florida. But since then, he has gotten a promotion because he's so good and he's such a great spokesperson for the community. And so I'm going to read this. Brandon Wolf is a nationally recognized civil rights and gun safety advocate and a seasoned communications expert. He currently serves as the national press secretary for the Human Rights Campaign, the nation's oldest and largest LGBTQ civil rights organization. Everybody, please welcome and give big ups and hearts to my friend Brandon J. Wolf. How are you, my friend?
I'm good. Happy Pride. Happy Pride. It feels a little defiant to say that in this environment. And so I'm just going to keep on saying it.
Keep saying it. I was just at an event last night and literally opened my remarks with Happy Pride because it's like at this point, it is almost like you said, those are defiant words in these times, right? I mean, This is Pride Month. It's also Black Music Month, like all the things that upset Pete Hegseth and Donald Trump. You know what I mean? Like, it's all the things they hate. And I just wanted to start by asking you just about that, the resonance of that moment. Last night, when I arrived at this event, I found out that the Defense Department, Pete Hegseth, the guy from Fox, they're looking to rename, to take the name of Harvey Milk off of the naval aircraft carrier that it's currently affixed to, along with removing the names of Harriet Tubman, removing the name of Thurgood Marshall and Medgar Evers. But Harvey Milk was the lead in that story because, of course, they timed that for the start of Pride. What do you make of what's happening?
Yeah, I mean, well, I thought of you right away because I saw that Medgar Evers is among the other names that will be scrubbed from these ships. And I know you've done so much incredible work to keep the story of Medgar Evers alive and well. It's embarrassing. It's all so silly, and it would be, you know, maybe comical if it weren't so disturbing. What is being done to divide this country and to politicize our military. Let's be clear that Harvey Milk is not just a civil rights hero. He's not just, you know, someone who paved the way for LGBTQ plus elected officials and queer people in politics generally. He's also a Navy veteran. He yeah. encapsulates so much of the courage that makes our military the envy of the world. And just as a note, Harvey Milk was forced to resign in 1955 after it was discovered that he was gay. He was honorably discharged as a lieutenant junior grade. So this is someone who, you know, even in the face of that kind of discrimination and hatred, still demonstrated the kind of courage and humility and selflessness that is required to be, you know, a service member in the military. So that's one thing, is just what a disgrace to the memory of Harvey Milk. What a disgrace to the LGBTQ plus community to do this during Pride Month, but also how embarrassing for Pete Hegseth. Because again, to be clear, the only men that are triggered by rainbows and gay rights icons are weak and insecure men. Secure men do not go to great lengths to scrub the names of gay icons off of ships. That is what weak and secure men do. And Pete Hegseth is being weak and insecure and petty at a time when we actually have real problems to solve, right? It is essentially a sideshow that is, you know, I think an attempt to distract the American people from the harsh reality that this administration is a train wreck. It's a dumpster fire. And it has not just been disastrous for LGBTQ plus people. It's been disastrous for the entire country. We're in a seesawing trade war that changes its shape every single day. We have a president who said he was going to solve global crises on day one and is now saying maybe he'll never get around to it. We have a ketamine infused narcissist who was having the president babysit his child in the Oval Office instead of solving real problems. And at the very same time, this administration has tried to scapegoat the LGBTQ plus community, has come after our rights and freedoms and education and healthcare and otherwise. So again, it is embarrassing. It is a disgrace to the memory of Harvey Milk. It's a disgrace to the LGBTQ plus community. It's embarrassing for people like Pete Hegseth, who are clearly so weak and insecure that they got to do whatever they can to distract from their own failures in this moment. And it's such a shame that it's the taxpayers who are going to have to bear the burden of scrubbing these names off the side of a ship, who are going to have to deal with this sideshow while real problems that need to be solved go unsolved in this country.
Right. I mean, I think about the waste of, you're right. There are two aspects of it. There, as you said, there's the foolishness of it. I mean, they're so desperate to have LGBTQ people erased from military history. They scrubbed the Enola Gay from the websites. The Enola Gay was the bomb, was the bombardier, the ship involved in dropping nukes on Japan. The Enola Gay was not a gay person.
No.
Well, this is what had the word gay in it. It had to go.
This is what happens when you combine a bunch of, you know, incompetent clowns who are completely unqualified for the jobs they have with, you know, ChatGPT, and you let it run amok inside the United States government. I mean, it's, you know, we got a car salesman and his 19-year-old intern who prefers to go by Big Balls are the most qualified people to be making decisions about what happens with America's checking account? I think not. But that's the kind of inept leadership that you should expect from Donald Trump. That's who he's always been. Of course, it's who he is now. And it's no different when you're talking about Pete Hegseth, who, you know, again, is deeply unqualified for this job, should not be in this position, should never have been confirmed, should never have been nominated in the first place. And so it's unsurprising that all he has to offer up is this weak, pretty pathetic sideshow instead of doing the actual job of being the defense secretary.
Yeah, it's shameful, but also it's costing us money. Let's talk about the cost for a minute, because you mentioned they're going to have to spend money to undo the name, you know, to scrape these names off of the ships and I guess put, I don't know, who are they going to put on instead of Medgar Evers, Byron De La Beckwith? Like, who do they want on there? Who do they prefer? Because he, too, is a World War II veteran, I shall note. But, you know, they want white men, white, straight Christian men. They want their names on everything. Okay, we get that, Pete. You've made that abundantly clear. But you're going to waste money doing that. They're about to waste millions, tens of millions of dollars throwing Donald Trump a birthday military parade down the streets of Washington, D.C., which is probably going to ruin the streets. I've had some sources tell me that they're raiding the museums in neighboring and other states because there aren't enough tanks available to roll down the streets of D.C. And some of the tanks they want to pull out of museums don't even function anymore. So they're going to have to figure out a way to get them to D.C. And dragging a giant tank over the bridges and roads of D.C. is going to ruin the roads. So now they're going to have to pay to fix the roads they destroy to have this parade. And this is not something the military normally does. We're talking about the taxpayer getting soaked for tens of millions of dollars when they're cutting Medicaid, when they're cutting Meals on Wheels, when they're cutting food stamps. It's disgusting.
Yeah, it's disgusting. And what a stain on this country and, you know, and its history. We used to be the envy of the world in terms of, you know, innovation. We used to be the envy of the world in terms of our economic engine. And people came here to take big risks and try new ideas and find safety and belonging and start new businesses and get a great education. And instead, we have Grifter in Chief and his, you know, merry band of scam artists who, as you said, are draining the American people every single day by the millions, if not 10 millions of dollars to stroke these egos, right, of these really, again, weak and insecure men. A strong, confident man does not need a parade that has to raid local museums to drag out old tanks to scrape up the roads in Washington, D.C. He just goes in the Oval Office, rolls up his sleeves, and does the job that he was elected to do. He understands that public service also means service. At its core, it is about, you know, a selfless act for, you know, for the greater good. But I think the question you're asking about the money is what's most intensely on my mind. What's the invoice for the American people, right? How much are we supposed to foot here in terms of the bill to make Donald Trump feel good about himself, to make Pete Hegseth feel qualified and competent for his job? How much of our hard work do we have to pour into making these men feel good about themselves and the work that they do to gloss over their mediocrity? When, as you said, people can't afford rent, they can't afford to buy a home, they can't afford to keep food on the table. Congress is talking about knocking 13 plus million people off of their health care, people who need it most, right? People who are on Medicaid, because they say that we're so broke we can't pay the bills. And yet we can find money to stroke the egos of people like Donald Trump and Pete Hegseth. It is, again, so deeply embarrassing. It is such a stain on this country and its history, and it's going to have real devastating consequences, again, for people who need these things the most.
Yeah, and, you know, it very well said, but, you know, there are two things here. I think that people look at their immediate pecuniary interests, they look at their economic interests and the struggles immediately, but the big picture can sometimes get away from folks. I recently had a conversation. We interviewed Jason Stanley, who's the expert on fascism, and that interview is going to air, by the way, on the Joy Reid Show very soon. But one of the things that in his newest book, Erasing History, that he talks about is the fact that attacks on gay people, on trans people, on LGBTQ people are a core signal of fascism. It's something that's happened in every fascist country that has been studied, and it's part and parcel of the same impulse that causes people to ban abortion, to try to force women out of the workforce and to focus on home and making babies for the state, that it's all part of one package because the goal is to take the preferred men of the right race, elevate them, remove any barriers to the creation of more of them, right? And force heterosexual, normative, creative, you know, creation of more babies for the state. And so gay people are an inherent threat, right? trans people are an inherent threat to that system. And also LGBTQ people in some cases tend to be more visible in other targeted things like the arts. And so they're visible. And so what do you make of when you think about these individual attacks on gay people, on history, on LGBTQ history? I mean, they took the trans people off of Stonewall.
Right.
The trans people did Stonewall, right?
That's right.
When you go to the monument, they took them off. And so what do you make of it? And do you see it as a darker sign of fascism or as just stupidity?
Yeah, I think it's a couple of things. So, you know, when you think about the Trump regime and what it requires, it needs a scapegoat, right? Because Donald Trump is not going to solve any actual problems. He's not going to make anyone's life better. He's not going to make things cheaper. He's certainly not going to bring jobs back to the United States of America so long as he is punishing businesses for, you know, creating those jobs in this country. And so in order to distract from that, he needs a scapegoat to tell you why your life continues to be challenging in this country. And it's, you know, it's so much easier for him to point the finger at LGBTQ plus people, at Black and Brown people, at immigrants, at disabled people, at women, at, you know, marginalized communities than he is to point the finger back at himself when he is indeed the problem. So I think, you know, the Trump administration needs a scapegoat and LGBTQ plus people become an easy scapegoat. And of course, the right wing knows, based on their focus groups and their polling, that trans people in particular and trans young people in particular are an easy scapegoat for them. Most Americans don't know a trans person. They've never heard a trans person's story. And so they become susceptible to the misinformation and disinformation of the right wing about that community. But I think your bigger question about fascism is really important, because I've always said that LGBTQ plus people represent the greatest threat to fascists and authoritarians, which is something they can't control. LGBTQ plus people live outside the confines of patriarchy, live outside the confines of, you know, being boiled down to your reproductive capacity. We sort of represent freedom and liberation because we get to say that boys don't have to wear blue, and girls don't have to wear pink. You know, boys can play with Barbies and girls can play with Tonka trucks, and all of those things are normal. Because we're complex human beings. But fascism requires conformity. It requires that everybody toe the line, that everybody live inside the boxes they've been assigned. It requires a patriarchal structure that tells you there's only one right way to live, only one right way to build a family, only one right way to love, and that we will use the power of government if you step outside those lines to punish you. So I think, you know, again, on the one hand, you have the Trump regime who's looking for a scapegoat, and LGBTQ plus people historically have been an easy scapegoat. And then on the other hand, this broader existential question, which is, you know, why do fascists target groups like LGBTQ plus people? And it's because our existence represents the thing they fear most, which is the freedom to live outside the lines.
Well said. And the other thing I would love for you to talk about a little bit, you know, there is the military piece of it where there are people under direct threat. I mean, they are removing trans people from the military. They're saying they can no longer serve. They're discharging people. And I believe they're giving people honorable discharges, at least, so they could hopefully get their pensions. I don't even know. But on the other side of things, they're putting a lot of pressure on all these other things, including the arts. You saw Bruce Springsteen come out and get a lot of praise, but also make a lot of people mad for speaking up, you know, for the artistic communities. But then you've also seen a lot of Hollywood sort of dial back. You know, one of the things that has really triggered the right in Hollywood is the representation of gay people and relationships in movies and TV shows and series, etc. Do you fear that Hollywood won't stand up like Bruce Springsteen did in music, or like the Kennedy Center has tried to do? Do you worry that, you know, the greater culture will pull back because they're scared?
I don't think so. I think long term, the, you know, inspiring people to be unapologetic about who they are, to be out and proud, is a genie you can't put back in the bottle. There is no changing the fact that the world that Donald Trump and Mike Johnson and J.D. Vance and the entire right wing is so afraid of is a world that's already here, right? 30%+ of Gen Z identifies as part of the LGBTQ plus community. LGBTQ plus people have over $1.4 trillion in spending power in this country. You can't put that genie back in the bottle. There is no president who can erase that fact, that reality. There is no executive order that can push all of those people back into the closet. So they try their hardest. They wield every weapon they have to try to bully and scare people into submission. But those people aren't going anywhere. Those LGBTQ plus people aren't going anywhere. And I do think that the targeting of the arts and of history and of Hollywood is really intentional. And it comes from, again, this deep fear that they have, because stories are the best inoculation to their disinformation. We know that. The data tells us as soon as someone meets a trans person, they are far more likely to support that person's fight for freedom. They want to see that person get access to healthcare. They want to see them be able to get a job, to serve in the military, to get an apartment. They want to see them have access to the American dream just like everyone else. That is true across the board. When people hear the stories, when they get to know their neighbors, their family members, their friends, they are much more likely to stand in solidarity with those people. And so, again, fascists, authoritarians, the right wing are terrified of the freedom that comes with storytelling. And so they try to squash the stories. They try to scrub the history books. They try to whitewash, the troubled, the dark, the violent history of this country, because telling those stories, being honest about who we are and who we're going to be, inspires people to imagine that something better is possible. And they certainly can't have that.
Absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. Well, I have to now turn it to something. We have to talk about something fun. So I literally wanted so badly to go to the Janelle Monáe concert that is actually taking place tomorrow. I'm very bummed. I'm going to be on a flight, so I'm going to miss it. But I really want to go. It's Grace Jones and Janelle Monáe.
It doesn't get better than that.
I'm so sad, but I'm really wishing the best. And they're both two amazing people. But that would have been one of our fun things that my daughter and I were going to do for Pride. What are you going to do that's fun for Pride?
Oh, my God. I'm going to try to sneak backstage to meet Troye Sivan. Don't tell anybody I said that. And if I pop up with a picture.
Said it.
I know. Everybody knows. Don't tell anybody. Don't tell anybody. But no, that will be, I'm going to try to enjoy the parade. I'm going to try to, get out to a show, a concert or two. And honestly, like, the fight is fun for me too. The protest is fun for me too. So on Friday at 5 at the Supreme Court, we're going to have a rally to bring Andre Hernandez Romero home, the Venezuelan asylum seeker who was disappeared by the Trump administration to El Salvador. And then on Sunday, I'm going to rally too at the Lincoln Memorial. Like, all of that brings me joy to be in community with people. So I'm going to get a little piece of all of it. Celebration and protest.
Absolutely. And what is our updates on this young man? Because he is a makeup artist. Yeah. He is not a gang member.
That's right.
He had a crown tattooed on himself for the idea of a queen, not for the idea of, and he's there along with a soccer coach who had a crown as well because he loves Real Madrid as his favorite soccer team. I mean, they as randomly as they are stripping people off of the military websites, they're also grabbing and disappearing people and then saying they're all gang members, which is a very fascistic tactic. Do we have any updates on this young man, where he is?
Yeah. So one, you're making such an important point, which is that if someone can be stripped of their due process willy-nilly, if the president can, unilaterally decide that someone doesn't belong here and just boot them without the process that they are due, they could do it to anyone. So if you think that because you are not an appetizer, you're not on the menu, you have another thing coming. And all of us need to be saying out loud that this is unacceptable. We cannot be disappearing people to random, prison camps in El Salvador. People are due process in this country. That's part of freedom and justice and equality for all. So Andre Hernandez Romero, as you mentioned, is a Venezuelan asylum seeker. He fled to this country because he was being persecuted for being gay in Venezuela, and he sought safety here. He sought belonging here. But the Trump administration unilaterally decided that they didn't want him here. They disappeared him without notice to El Salvador. Again, he's from Venezuela. No one's quite clear on why he is in El Salvador in a prison. And folks have not heard from him since then. The HHS Secretary Kristi Noem, noted puppy killer Kristi Noem, was asked during a hearing in front of a congressional committee if she would commit to at least confirming whether he is alive or dead, and she refused to do that. She refused to do a wellness check for Andre. So folks are not clear on Andre's well-being right now. I know his attorneys are trying hard to make sure that he is being at least treated with a basic level of humanity while they fight to bring him back to the United States. And I think a court recently said that if he can be brought back to the United States, if he is brought back here, then his asylum claim should continue, that it was a legal asylum claim. And so, again, the fight to bring Andre back to this country continues. And it is this bigger fight about we don't just disappear people to prison camps in El Salvador. So brutal, by the way, that their own justice minister has said that the only way to get out of that prison is in a coffin. We don't do that in this country. That's not freedom. That's not due process. That's not justice. And every single one of us deserves better, and we should stand up.
And you should note, we should note that the Donald Trump, when President Bukele was in the White House, got caught on a hot mic whispering to him, the homegrowns are next. And they've also reportedly been having conversations with South Sudan and Libya and other countries, and I believe Syria, to send people, to send migrants. But they also have made it very clear, Donald Trump and Tom Homan and the gang, and Stephen Miller, that whole crowd, that they actually have their eyes on Americans too. So don't think that it couldn't happen to you. Brandon, it is always such a pleasure speaking with you. You are such a force. I'm your biggest fan. I'm your publicist, basically, because
I love that.
The smartest young man in Florida. So, no, there are a lot of great people in Florida. I have a lot of friends in Florida. They're all going to be mad at me and yell at me. But you are so brilliant. You are so committed. You are such a great fighter. And also, you fight with joy and with style.
Always. And I try.
Yes, you do. You do. Well, I appreciate and appreciate love you. I appreciate you so much. And thank you so much, so much for being here.
You too. Anytime.
Happy Pride.
Anytime. Happy Pride, everyone. Happy Pride.
I got my James Baldwin shirt on.
Love.
Can't erase him either. Ha! All right, y'all. Take care. Thank you all for joining. Thank you, everybody, for jumping in the live. Talk to you soon. And bye-bye.
Mayor Baraka, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start by talking about where we are right now. You were just speaking at the State of the People Power Tour rally. Why did you feel it was important to be here, given all that you have going on?
Well, one, it's in Newark, and I needed to be here and represent the city, but also because I think that it's important, especially now in this period, to have what's going on, to have a kind of organizing mechanism that's going around the country, trying to rally folks in our community up so they can see what's happening and be a part of this moment.
Let's talk about what's happening. Delaney Hall used to be a treatment facility. It was a place that was trying to help people.
Drug treatment and for people coming home from incarceration.
Okay.
So it was a halfway house as well.
And so do you know the condition of the people that are being held there? We're assuming these are undocumented migrants, or do we even know?
Well, that's what they say. Only thing we know is what they tell us. They're not transparent at all. They're not giving us any information at all. And that's part of the problem. Even with the certificate of occupancy, you have to declare, you know, what's happening here, who's in here, who's going to be in here, if it's children, if it's women, if it's families, if it's men. You have to say all of that, right?
You don't have the names of the people who are there. You don't know?
We have no idea who's in that property.
So let's talk about this, because there have been stories claiming that you were outside of that facility protesting, that you've been protesting outside the facility.
Right.
Is that true?
I never went there to protest. Every time I go there, I go every morning at 7 o'clock in the morning. I usually leave around 7:30, 7:45, because I know they're going to deny us entry. The objective here is to get them to deny us entry so we can, you know, kind of certify that, put it on the gate. So every time we go to court, we have a pattern of them denying entry to our folks. And we need people to witness that. And plus, our people don't want to go down there alone because they're afraid, right? And so I feel like we're going to send them there. We need to go with them. I told the business administrator, we need to be with them. And I have to tell them, look, if they don't let you in, don't go. I don't want you to do anything to put your license in jeopardy. I don't want you to go to jail. If anybody gets in trouble, it'll be me. You're down here at the behest of the city. There are protesters down there. And they've been down there every day. And they got a right to do that. I mean, one day they asked me to speak. I got up and spoke to them. And I have a right to do that. But every day I go there for that and I leave. There's not one day that I went down there to protest. The day that I got arrested, I went down there to support the Congress people. You know, they invited me to a press event that they were having after they were supposed to do the tour that never happened. But it was ICE officials and soldiers and police officers with masks. They were all out there. Nobody said anything to me. Nobody talked to me. Nobody asked me anything. They didn't say, leave, get out, beat it. You know, they stood there. I stood there, and the guy who let me in stood there until an hour and a half later when the guy from Homeland Security came, special agent in charge. Then we got in. He got into it with me. Then the Congress people came, and he started the attention off of me and started talking to them, yelling and screaming. Then, you know, he started threatening us, and the Congress people, you know, said, let's go, we're leaving. I said, I'm leaving. He told me to get out. I left. You can see, if you see the video, I walk out. I leave. He say, get out. I leave.
Clear the gate. Back up.
Thank you, Mayor.
I'm on the other side of the fence. Then one of the congressmen in there runs to the gate, says, hey, they coming to lock you up. And you can hear me say, why? I'm on the other side of the fence. They can't lock me up. So if this was like a plan, I would have said, great, let me go and get locked. I said, why? They can't arrest me. They can't. I'm not on their property anymore. What are you talking about? And I stood there, and then I saw, you see him coming, right? The Newark in me, I would have took off and gave chase. But at the end of the day, I just stood there because I couldn't believe it, honestly. I wanted to see what they really was going to do, and they did it. They went all the way.
And you're the only person who was arrested?
The only one.
What do you think that signals to the country? That, you know, I think that people have started to almost in some ways, I hope not, become numb to seeing immigrants grabbed off the streets by men who did not have badges or uniforms, through being thrown into vans and taken away. This is starting to happen on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And people are now seeing that continually with people who they know are immigrants. This is now an American mayor of the largest city in New Jersey, the son of a very famous poet, Ameri Baraka, is your dad, a well-known figure, and three members of Congress, all Americans. What does that signal to you?
Well, authoritarianism. They're trying to intimidate people, bully you. And they're claiming that other people are grandstanding. This is the ultimate grandstanding, what they're doing. They're trying to signal to the rest of the country that they're strong, they're powerful, they're in charge, and nobody can defy them. Signal their base that they're taking care of these Democrats and they're going to lock them up if they, you know, do anything that they think is wrong or against their agenda, that they're going to do that. They don't care who they are. Just put the fear in people, and hopefully people become paralyzed by this fear.
And what do you expect to happen?
Well, I mean, at this point, I don't really know. I know we have to go to court, and right now they're going to play it out. They're probably trying to use it as leverage to get or do whatever they want to, whatever their objective is in the end. If it's to keep me quiet or whatever it is, they're going to try to use that. They're wrong. We're right, right? And Paul Robeson said the power in our demands is that what we ask for is correct. So at the end of the day, like, we didn't do anything wrong. I didn't do anything wrong, and I'm not going to acquiesce and make these people believe I did something wrong.
You're running for governor. You're in a Democratic primary. The primary is June 10th. The last I checked, you were running third in the polls. Mikey Sherrill is also running. The mayor of Jersey City is also in the race. Do you think that what happened to you will change people's conceptions in terms of what kind of a governor this state needs?
I think people in the state of New Jersey, especially Democrats and a few independents, wanted that anyway. I mean, you could see people's commercials changing. When I first started running, I was automatically talking about from the beginning that we need to push back against what's happening in this country. Then Trump just got worse and worse and worse. And so that elevated what I was saying. And so now everybody else is talking about how they're going to push back against Donald Trump. So it changed the talking point, became a wedge issue about what he's doing, taking people's Medicaid, closing veterans' offices. All of this stuff scared the bejesus out of people. We're going to shut down the Department of Education. People are afraid, you know, on both sides of the aisle, by the way. And so this changed, and people began talking about that more and more and more. And honestly, I think people want leadership now more than ever. And people are pretending to be progressive.
We are facing the most corrupt president this nation has ever had. He's attacking people. He's attacking Medicaid. He's attacking the Department of Education. And what's worse than all this is that he seems to be doing a lot of this where cruelty is the point. This is not a federal government you can work with.
We're not fighting hard enough to get these dollars back. And whatever dollars are there, we should get more of them to New Jersey for our taxpayers to help our families.
I'm trying to figure out why they have to wait to become the governor to get more money back from the government, because that's their job as congresspeople.
If you were the governor, if you became governor, what would be the difference in the way that you would deal with the administration and, you know, the way maybe your opponents would?
I mean, in terms of immigration, we need to stand in front of and pass the Immigrant Trust Act here in New Jersey that codifies our police departments not working with ICE to do the things that they're doing, making sure immigrants had access to resources in the state of New Jersey, giving them access to lawyers, funding community-based organizations so that they can be represented, especially if people with green cards and student visas are being attacked because of what they believe and think, and professors. And we need to unite with other states. I think that because people are doing their individual thing, Democrats are doing that, you see a lot of people are beginning to waffle. So I think that if Gavin Newsom and Westmore and Pritchett and all these other people got together, Maine, all these other people got together and formed a kind of united front, right? Putting our AGs together to push back, not just individual cases, but collective ones, sharing resources to push back against Donald Trump, that we had a collective agenda and not an individual one, I think we would be further along. Because people feel like they're out here on their own, you start to see Gretchen Whitmer, you start to see Gavin Newsom a little bit peeling back, you know, trying to talk about how you're going to work with Trump. Even in the debate last night, they say to me, so how can people trust that you won't interfere with federal officers? And, you know, as the governor, would this be the right way to behave? And I'd say, at first, I didn't interfere with federal officers. That's number one. But number two, yes, I think it is the right way to behave. We're in a moral moment right now in this country. And history is going to judge people's behavior and their actions and their words during this time, just like we judge everybody during the Jim Crow era, or we judged everybody during slavery, or we judge everybody during the Holocaust. America was being judged when people were marching and having rallies in New York City during the rise of Hitler. Like, people judge that. They're going to judge what you're saying. Your silence is going to be judged in this moment, because this is a chaotic moment, not just for the country, but for the world, right? And so I think now you need to raise your voice more than ever.
Democratic Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett of Texas. She is a member of the House Oversight and Judiciary Committees. Let's just pick up on what Jacob was saying. There are real impacts of the steel and aluminum tariffs. Marketplace had a great section in their piece today about how this could show up on your grocery bill. Pardon me, yesterday. The U.S. imports nearly 70% of tin-plate steel that manufacturers use for cans of fruit, vegetables, essential foods, and pet foods. If these tariffs remain in effect, we're likely to start seeing all sorts of prices go up at the grocery store. The cans, we talk about the air fryers. I can't live without my air fryer. These are real life.
I ain't
cooking nothing, but yeah, go ahead. You know, just, I put the wings in there, give them a little more crispy. Okay, but now for the folks that can't afford the air fryers are already expensive. It is going up.
Yeah. Listen, I appreciate Bobby because honestly, a lot of the things that I am trying to bring to the forefront for the American people, they really are not partisan things, or they should not be partisan things. This is about right versus wrong, and it's about harm versus help. And so basically what I'm trying to let people know is that, listen, the Democrats, you know, you give us a little something and we will do our part to hopefully at least stop the harm. But right now, people are being harmed no matter who you voted for and no matter how you affiliate yourself. And it's important, and I appreciate y'all, and I appreciate Jacob going out, because it's important that we tell those stories and let them know that, guess what, MAGA or not, you are still being impacted detrimentally by this administration and their policies. Now, it's interesting because just today, I had the national realtors that came by to see me from all over the country. And most people don't understand, like, what all goes into housing. They just complain and say, listen, the housing is too high. Well, there's a lot of things that go into why our housing is so high. And frankly, we can't just come up with one piece of legislation to fix that, right? But just imagine what happens when things like steel go up, right? We're talking about condos, we're talking about homes, we're talking about these things, and it's like now the steel is more expensive. So do you think your house is going to get cheaper anytime soon? Not really. And not to mention, this is ruining a relationship that we have with our friends up north. People aren't necessarily specifically addressing it, but Canada is where we get the vast majority of our steel from. We get a lot of steel and lumber from Canada, but guess what? We actually may be in a situation where they play with us too, because we take a lot of their energy as well. So some people may not have energy one day when they wake up.
That's true. Well, I mean, particularly in a lot of the northwestern states, the midwestern states closer to the Canadian border, they do share that electric grid with Canada. And the Canadians have already indicated, if you want to play this game, we can play too. I think both you and Bobby, though, make a very important point that was laid out in the CBO report, which, by the way, the Congressional Budget Office for Republicans, you know that that's the House. So those numbers come from the House. It's not like Democrats are just making them up. But they noted the changes in tariffs will reduce the size of the U.S. economy. Inflation will increase by an annual average of 0.4 of a percentage point in 2025 and 2026. And CBO's estimation, reducing the purchasing power of households and businesses. So to Bobby there in his warehouse, and to the moms and the dads and the families in your district, this is real.
Yeah.
And what the administration is doing by sort of blindly saying or inferring that somehow this is going to be a way of owning the libs, or somehow, you know, this is going to punish Democrats more than it's going to punish Republicans, it's just utter BS.
Yeah.
The real thing is what Bobby said, as a guy who supports the president.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's important that what we're seeing is that the internal civil war, the family fight, is coming out into the public, right? You know, Bobby was still very nice about everything that he had to say, and felt like it was okay to disagree. And a lot of times we sit there and are like, hello? Hello, are y'all paying attention? Because, like, this is impacting y'all, too. Like, say something, right? And so now that there's, like, the family infighting, we see, you know, even Elon Musk, honey, he can't get out of the Twitter, right? Like, he is talking about the bill and trying to take the bill and telling people, call your senators and make sure you take this bill down. And listen, I never thought there would be a day that I would agree with Elon on anything. But that's where we are, where people are finally starting to say, you know what, this is actually impacting me a little too much. I'm gonna have to speak up and speak out against this. But my issue is this. All of y'all voted for this so that it would hurt somebody else. The problem was, you got upset when you found out that, oh shoot, it can hurt me too. And honestly, it's ingrained in who Democrats are, is that we actually care and we love and we want to take care of everybody, and that's why we got this big tent party and we all over the place. But I will tell you that compassion is something that we are missing in Congress.
Yes.
Like, caring is something that we are missing in politics in general. Mm-hmm. And that's the only way you can justify a senator going out there and saying, well, everybody gonna die, and then decide that you're going to do your apology, not so much an apology, in what looked like a graveyard. I'm like, listen, ain't nobody elect you to be anybody's grave digger. They elected you to do everything that you can to make sure that their lives were flourishing and getting better and that they were living as long as they could.
That's part of the job. Part of the job is also in your current position, watching what this administration is doing and making sure that they are accountable. You recently threw your hat in the ring to be ranking member on the House Oversight Committee, saying in your dear colleague letter, Americans are demanding a more strategic, aggressive, and energetic fight. What do you think that fight should look like?
I think it looks like a lot of things. Listen, here's the deal. We as Democrats can sit there and say, oh, you know what? He violating the emoluments clause of the Constitution. And the average person's like, say, what now? What are you talking about, right? So, number one, I think that we have to deal with that and explain to people why it is so bad, because he will go out there and say, yo, me getting a free plane from the Qataris, like, that just means that, you know what, we don't have to spend this money on a plane, right? Like, he can explain it to people that don't understand why we have these rules and why the Constitution was looking out for us. So it's a matter of bringing that in, having a hearing, and then making sure that we translate it and we amplify it. It's not big enough just to go on TV. Love y'all, appreciate y'all, but like, communications has to be a full-on kind of strategy. And that is something that I've worked really hard to do, because I want to make sure that I'm not just screaming into a vacuum. I also want to make sure that we're amplifying the voices. We've got so much amazing talent that's on that committee, but we need a leader that literally can lift up the entire team so that people say, you know what, we actually starting to believe in the Democrats. There's more than just one or two of them that are fighting. But also, I think that we just got to be real and we got to go hard, right? Like, there's only one person, Donald Trump does not want in that seat. It is me. Like, point blank, period. And same thing with a Republican colleague out of North Carolina that was like, I'm fearful because I'm not going to hold back. Now, listen, this doesn't mean that I plan to be partisan in any way, but as a trained trial attorney, we're going to follow these facts. We're going to follow the evidence and we are going to make it plain. I also think that we can't just say, well, we're in the minority, so we can't do anything. I don't believe in that rhetoric. I believe in fighting. And that's exactly what I've been doing. So, like, does this mean that we take the fight to their backyard? Absolutely. Because those people may not be tuning in. So allowing me to go and do shadow hearings on the road where I'm going into Republican districts and the people that are testifying are the people that have been impacted, whether they lost their jobs or whether they lost funding for Meals on Wheels or whatever it is, to tell their story so that their neighbors can hear them, and then they will know that we are listening and we are not here just because it's election time. We are here because we actually want to heal this country.
In the time that we have left, I just to follow up on this, the last time this seat was open and there was a race within the Democratic caucus for this particular seat, former leadership weighed in and members weighed in to say that we don't want that person, we want this person. Do you have a sense now that there is the leadership maybe is going to take a different tact, and or former leadership might also take a different tact?
Listen, you trying to beat around the bush. Everybody at home know what you're talking about.
Nancy Pelosi weighed in, and she said, not that person, I want this person. Do you think she's going to weigh in this time?
If so,
is she weighing in for you?
I don't think she's going to weigh in at all. There is someone from California that is running, so if she does weigh in, I would imagine it may end up being a delegation person, but as a woman who became speaker, I think that there is something powerful. I am the only woman that is in this race. Not to say that that is like an end all be all, but I think that she understands the challenges of what it is to rise through the ranks, even beyond kind of you having the qualifications and you being able to show the bona fides. You know, there's numbers that I mentioned in my letter for a reason. Like, you talk about your numbers because they're strong, right? Like, it's not really normal for a freshman to raise over $4 million for DCCC. It's not really normal for a sophomore black woman in a safe Democratic seat to raise $1.7 million and become the seventh highest fundraising Democrat in Q1. Like, these are not, you know, or for a sophomore to have traveled to over and done over 100 events on behalf of other people. So what I'm trying to do is let everybody know that I'm a team player. And that's exactly what I hope, you know, comes across. I don't anticipate, though, that the former speaker is weighing in. I've been talking to people while my letter just went out. I have been talking to people, and I did not get a sense that the former speaker had weighed in. I will tell you, though, that seniority is a thing that, you know, Alex mentioned when she said she wasn't going to run again. I think, you know, it's hard for certain people who have come up through this system to then say, you know what, I'm going to let it go. And it's been important for me to tell people that, Listen, if we just had a halfway normal person in the White House, I wouldn't be running, because I really do respect seniority, especially because of the history of it, mm-hmm. especially for like the Black caucus. But at the same time, if we don't meet this moment, I think that we're going to continue to see our numbers plummet. I think we're going to continue to lose a lot of our support. And I think that when we talk about diversity, as much as we do on our side of the aisle, that even means in our leadership. Mm-hmm. And so diversity comes from all different ways. And so we've done a lot of seniority kind of votes. I'm hoping that we can break the norm, at least in this particular race, and give someone a shot who really just wants to help our team.
Thank you, Dr. Ron. Let's put our hands together for Dr. Ron Daniels. Dr. Ron, we certainly appreciate your leadership, and just bringing us together like this is so powerful. And again, let's put our hands together for all of these dynamic men and women that are here just sharing so much. Come on, let's put our hands together for them. I want to just quickly go back to the Marcus Messiah Garvey agenda and movement that was talked about earlier, because I think that is so key, so critical. And then let's link that to the final messages and words, the mountaintop speech of Dr. Martin Luther King, and let's link that on the continent of Africa to the final mission and work of Nelson Mandela. And hopefully all of that should get us as a race of people right where we need to be now, and how we move to the next level. And that is, at the end of the day, there has to be a commitment to what I call a globalized Black economic agenda. That is so key. That was such a huge part of what Marcus Messiah Garvey was all about. It's, you know, how do we harness all of the resources that we have and begin to look at the kind of impact that we need to bring to bear. I appreciate the fact that we're gathered here today. And again, we were here last year, and we certainly appreciate the organizers here in Grenada for bringing this about. But I got to make the point that in the future, there needs to be more Grenadans in the room, more business people in the room, more clergy leaders in the room, so that when we walk away, there are very specific steps around what we will do next, and the parties are at the table that's going to help to implement and to move that forward. I think that is so critical to the process. Then let me just touch upon a couple of the things that I think we need to stop doing as a race of people. We've spent too much time incorporating and grafting everybody else in our empowerment struggle, and it has not worked for us. The whole idea of the Rainbow Coalition has not worked for us. The diversity, equity, and inclusion that is now being challenged in the United States have not worked effectively for us. Let me tell you why. The Indians are doing very, very well. Everywhere in the world, they're doing well. In my community where I live in central New Jersey, it is totally controlled by Indians. Now, let me give you a perspective. Wayfair, for those of us in the United States, is located in Cranberry, New Jersey. Wayfair, an Indian-owned corporation, has grown to become one of the largest of its kind in the world. Bola, that you'll find at almost every mobile gas station in the world, another Indian-owned enterprise. They are doing well everywhere in the world. I'm in South Africa 3-4 times a year. The Indians are doing well. I'm just coming from Seoul, Korea. I was totally shocked. My last time in Seoul, Korea was 15 or so years ago. Today, the place is totally developed. The shacks no longer exist. townships no longer exist in South Korea. They are doing well. So as a result of all that we have done such a great job empowering everybody else. And I really believe it's time for us to look at how we empower ourselves. If we bring that home to Grenada for a moment, here goes a small country, only 115,000 people, a GDP of less than $2 billion. But Grenada is the second largest producer of nutmeg in the world. So why is nutmeg not fully owned by Grenadans everywhere in the world? I really believe it is time for black people to do one thing. We must bring, and yes, there are other communities that should come later. I believe that the African world, the Caribbean world in particular, and the African-American community need to forge a partnership that is founded on an economic agenda. I'm not negating the importance of the other agendas, but I do believe that what black people need is a four-tier process at the foundation of our move for economic growth. Economic power must be a spiritual inculcation. We tie culture to that. We tie all of these other elements to that, but that's at the foundation. That economic power must drive, the spiritual foundation must drive economic power. We talk too little about economics. We are almost afraid. We have socialized our agenda to the degree that we have minimized the role that economics ought to play. And that's why I really want to commend Dr. Ron that the first conversation we're having here is about economics, because that's what everything got to be built on. We got to come to the understanding when we look at all other races, they never have to do the social agenda issues as we black people are doing. Why? Because they understand, well, if we're able to advance the economic agenda, the social transformation will automatically happen. Because guess what? If you own your community, if you own your banks, if you own your industries, if you own the resources around you, you have your own capacity to guide what you do socially. I want to challenge us to really understand that. And that is why the last mountaintop message from Dr. King was so important, because he recognized that at the end of the day, if blacks in America are going to get out of this mess, we're going to have to turn to the economic strategy. And the economic strategy for black people everywhere, especially now, it got to be two-tier. One element of the economic strategy has to be economic activism. We've gone far from that. We've done political activism. That's why we've got political freedom all across Africa. But we've failed to do economic activism. So as much as there's no longer apartheid, political apartheid in South Africa, there's still economic apartheid. So all this game that they're playing with us, about, white refugees from South Africa, I spent 4 months almost every year in South Africa. The reality is the richest square mile in the world is in South Africa. You want to tell the difference between white South Africans and black South Africans? I need everybody to write this down. It's important. Per capita for blacks in South Africa is $3,500. U.S. dollars. $3,500. That's the per capita for blacks in South Africa. Write down the per capita for whites. $121,000, the highest in the world, to the degree that even the New York Times says that South Africa is the most unequal country in the world. That's our reality. So I really, if I were to put this in context and make a call, and that is to really suggest that when we come next year, I think it is so important that we organize, that the chambers are here, that small businesses are here, so that we're creating the right kind of partnership. I remember years ago when I met Dr. Roy Hastic, who happens to be the late Dr. Roy Hastic. He was the president for the Caribbean American Chamber of Commerce and Industry in New York City. I kind of helped to shape that. I was the one who got the first $200,000 to fund that organization through Paula Ralph Lauren. And by the way, that was through activism. So we have to use activism to challenge the economic exploiters to reduce their exploitation and to provide partnerships. And on the flip side of that, we have to better empower black businesses at every level. We spend too much time complaining about the challenges that we will always be complaining about them, because the challenges will always be there. At the end of the day, we have to spend more time making sure that we are building more black businesses. Let them thrive. It's okay if they're not supporting all the stuff that you need. You know, trust me, we will benefit one way or another from successful black businesses. Successful black billionaires, the whole concept of them doing business, hiring from within, it is pitiful just to consider the fact that in America, despite all the black businesses that we have, and we don't have that many, that black businesses employ the least black people, because most of our businesses don't even have employees. Right. I end, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Over the past few years, the COVID-19 pandemic has affected how we live our daily lives. Today, we also face a mental health pandemic that threatens our well-being as we attempt to rebuild our social networks and communities.
The pandemic has reminded us to value family, community, and our human connections. However, it has also left many of us feeling more isolated, confused, and alone, struggling to find meaning amid loss and uncertainty.
Today, 1 in 5 Americans experience emotional and mental health challenges. But many of us do not understand what we are facing or know how to ask for help.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, we understand what you are going through, and we are here to help. Our vision is to build a mentally healthy nation for all. We work every day to eliminate stigma, combat mental illness and substance use disorders, and advance mental health. If you or someone you love needs help, you are not alone. Please visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.
My name is Ariel. When I arrived in the U.S. at 19, I struggled to find job opportunities without my high school diploma. My entire life changed when I took a chance and got my high school diploma.